From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, Hollywood is no longer a place where anything goes. Just ask Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn. Then, the documentary Far From the Tree explores how families deal with a child who's different.
When you love somebody, it really doesn't matter. You can find such exquisite joy in learning to be that intimate with someone who's that different.
We'll also meet the LA musician who recently won NPR's Tiny Desk Concert Contest. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in today for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We begin today with yet more fallout in Hollywood over powerful people doing or saying things that maybe they shouldn't. In this case, it's James Gunn, director of the Guardians of the Galaxy franchise. On Friday, the Walt Disney Company fired Gunn over a series of lewd jokes he made via Twitter several years ago. Some of those jokes involved rape and child molestation. Gunn is also a loud critic of President Donald Trump. And the old tweets were dug up and amplified across the web by pro-Trump alt-right activists. I asked Wall Street Journal media reporter Joe Flint what led Disney to pull the trigger on Gunn so quickly.
It does seem like that sort of due diligence will be something we will see more companies doing in this era where it's so easy for a mob mentality on either side of the political spectrum to rise up and really push a company into a corner.
Well, characters on the extreme political right who traffic in white nationalism, white supremacy, including Mike Cernovich, are taking credit for dredging up and publicizing these jokes that Gunn made 5 to 10 years ago. Any sense of how well orchestrated their attempts are at singling out Hollywood figures in general, especially those who they may disagree with politically?
Well, it's certainly a growing industry for them, and obviously this was a pretty big whale that they landed in James Gunn. And I want to be fair, this seems to be a new thing, and it can be on both sides of the political spectrum, because I have seen it happen on the other side as well. And I think the real question here for companies such as Disney is, okay, so where is your line? Where are your boundaries? And what distinguishes someone making, you know, again, off-color, poor taste, but clearly from anyone reading them, the takeaway would have to be these are just bad jokes from a very juvenile mind. But I just sort of wonder where the line is here and what's the message that they are sending when they respond so quickly to this kind of pressure to get rid of them from basically an extreme and, in the grand scheme of things, probably relatively small, albeit vocal group.
Well, unlike James Gunn, who immediately acknowledged and apologized for the insensitivity of his jokes, Paramount TV executive Amy Powell, who allegedly made racially charged comments during a business meeting, is denying she ever made such comments and says she will fight these allegations and that she will be vindicated. Is that something new, that kind of approach? And, you know, might she be vindicated, or could that really backfire somehow?
Well, I've reported on this one extensively. So just based on my reporting and how Paramount handled it, this was a very high-ranking executive there who was well-liked. The CEO of Viacom, my sources tell me, was very fond of her. This incident happened, a conference call with a bunch of people about a TV show, and she made some remarks about black people, and one of the people on the call was offended and raised it with her boss, who was also on the call, and they made a complaint to HR. And there was an investigation, and what hurt Amy Powell, from my understanding, from my reporting, as much as what she may have said, was she not only denied saying these things, my sources told me she denied there was ever a call. And that is what I'm told really led to her dismissal from Paramount, because they did not want to get rid of her. They wanted to find a way to just sort of, you know, work with her. We'll issue an apology. We'll do some sensitivity training. You know, obviously, this is not really reflective of who you are. And, you know, I talked to a lot of people in the business who were surprised. You know, these jobs are very demanding, and they're pressure cookers. And Hollywood has long been known as having sort of a freewheeling, say what you want, do what you want culture. And What I found most telling about what happened here with Amy Powell was that it was an assistant who raised the red flag, not one of the other power players. And I've seen that happen in other cases in town where sort of those who, quote unquote, know how the game is played are the last ones to sort of say, gee, that doesn't sound right, or that's horrible behavior. It's usually someone junior who either doesn't have, quote unquote, skin in the game or isn't so entrenched in the system to that they can't step back and say, you know, this just doesn't seem right to me.
Well, given that in Gunn's case and in the case of Roseanne, in both cases, there's no actual allegations or evidence of real physical abuse or discrimination, unlike, say, a Harvey Weinstein or a Kevin Spacey, where the allegations and the evidence is quite overwhelming. Is it possible for him, and maybe even for Roseanne someday, to come back after a time?
Well, I certainly think James Gunn will. I do not see this as some death sentence on his career. And I think even Roseanne has a fan base. Mm-hmm. I mean, Roseanne can probably go out and still make a very comfortable living doing stand-up. It's interesting. I know David Letterman is a beloved figure, but think about what would have happened if David Letterman was still on the air and we found out now about the affairs, mm-hmm. staffers on his show. I don't think the reaction would have been the same as the one he got many years ago, which was essentially a pass. So, it is a changing time, and I do think part of it is, sadly, it still comes down to, well, how important are you to a company? On the other hand, some folks who are very important to a company have also been let go. So I think people feel like there's a little bit more of a microscope on them, and they need to be aware.
That's Joe Flint, media reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Joe, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
After being fired last week, James Gunn responded in a series of tweets, including one that said, "Many people who have followed my career know when I started, I viewed myself as a provocateur, making movies and telling jokes that were outrageous and taboo. As I have discussed publicly many times, as I've developed as a person, so has my work and my humor." The new documentary, Far From the Tree, is, in a lot of ways, about what it means to be a family. Like the 2012 book of the same name by writer Andrew Solomon, the film examines what happens in a family when one child has a difference that sets them apart from their parents and their siblings. For Solomon, it was being gay. In doing research for his book, he found similar family dynamics at play with deafness and dwarfism. He also looked at how families deal with other seemingly disconnected circumstances, like children who commit crimes or who have schizophrenia. Rachel Dretson directed the documentary Far From the Tree, and as she told The Frame's John Horn, she first got the idea to turn Solomon's book into a film after she read a review in the New York Times.
You know, it leapt out at me. As soon as I read the review, it leapt out at me, and once I read the book, I knew it was meant to be a movie. I mean, the stories are incredibly emotional, and they all, I mean, there are many, many dozens of stories in the book as compared to the film, but every one of them has an incredibly powerful narrative arc in which, you know, a family struggles and then often finds a kind of redemption or healing or peace. And it sort of had all the ingredients of a terrific movie. And I also felt that a movie could bring a dimension to the story that a book just can't, because you can't see people. And so much of what Andrew writes about is the way people look. So I thought it would be really powerful to translate the book into a visual medium.
Was it important, too, that Andrew be a character in your film?
Yes. You know, the book has a real voice. It has a very particular perspective and tone, and it's Andrew's. And without Andrew's perspective, these stories could sort of feel like disparate, unrelated pieces of a larger puzzle. And it's really Andrew and his very unique way of seeing that binds them together. And one of the other, I think, really important pieces of the book and also the film is Andrew's perspective as a gay man who grew up at a time when being gay was seen as, in some cases, an illness, in other cases, serious deviance. and lived through a real transformation of the political landscape, in which now being gay in many, many parts of the country is celebrated and seen as an identity.
And having lived to see my supposed defect come to be celebrated, I wondered whether defectiveness itself might be all a matter of perspective. And if it's possible for the illness of homosexuality to turn into the identity of gayness, in what other instances might the world's point of view change? How do we decide what to cure and what to celebrate?
And Andrew, in the book, talks a lot about whether the same kind of shift in perspective could happen about some of the other identities he looks at in the book, for example, autism or dwarfism or deafness. Could there be a time where we don't see these things as liabilities or even deficits, but rather just differences? In some cases, differences to be very proud of.
I mean, that is really kind of the underlined idea of this film, isn't it? How do we decide, or why are we to decide what it is that we have to cure and what to celebrate?
Well, and who's to decide,
right?
I mean, there's a very powerful scene in the film where there's a board meeting of the Little People of America, and everybody's sitting around and discussing this new drug that's in clinical trials that potentially addresses dwarfism. Achondroplasia, which is the most common form of dwarfism. And, you know, there's the majority of people on this board aren't interested. And as one of our central characters says in the film, she says, "I don't think I need to be fixed." She really doesn't. And, you know, I think hopefully by the end of watching the film, a lot of the audience isn't sure any of these people need to be fixed. But you realize, you know, when you're exposed intimately to people who have some of these identities or conditions, how much bias and assumption we bring to the table when we look at people who are different.
Some of the subjects in your film often feel as if there aren't people like them out in the world. And there's a woman who has dwarfism. Her name is Loini, and she really doesn't know many other people who look like her. She's more or less cut off. And your cameras follow her as she attends the Little People of America's annual convention. And she walks into this convention, and her eyes light up in a way that is like a child on Christmas morning. Can you recall what that convention meant to her and what it meant to you to witness what it meant to her?
Well, that was, I think, one of my favorite experiences, actually, making the film. First of all, just personally speaking, as a person of average height, you know, walking into an environment in which everybody's smaller and you're the one who stands out is just such an incredibly intense and fantastic experience. And I can't overstate how transformative it was for us, my crew and me, to spend a week, you know, living in this community, which, by the way, is just unbelievably into itself as a community and just so celebratory. There's just so much joy in that place. So I think for Loini, who for all sorts of reasons, many of them socioeconomic, has really been isolated from other people who look like her for her whole life, it was like, I mean, you put it perfectly. I mean, I think she just lit up. And I mean, she's very shy. And so she kind of hid a lot of what she was feeling, but it was pretty obvious to those of us who knew her how excited she was. And then, of course, she makes a friend, her first friend, who's a dwarf as well. And that just, she just, you know, she was gone. You know, she was off with her friend for the rest of the convention.
We're talking with Rachel Dretson. She is the director and producer of the film Far From the Tree. I want to talk about another focus in your film, and that is of a young boy named Jack. He is on the autism spectrum, and he is essentially nonverbal. And his family tries every kind of therapy, trying to figure out a way to understand and communicate with their son. And finally, thanks to this amazing therapist, he is able to use a keyboard to communicate. So let's hear a scene from the film about what happens after a week of therapy when the therapist asks Jack what's wrong.
He typed out, "I'm trying, and I'm really smart." And then Jack was perfectly quiet. He was like, "Oh, I finally got it out after all these years."
And that was That was the moment when I just went, my God, he's in there.
Those are his parents talking. It's an unbelievable scene, but I think it really gets to another big part of the story of your film, and that is how parents see their children and how they question not only their own role in their child's makeup, but also how they see their kids in ways unlike the rest of the world.
You know, the sort of heart in many ways of the film is the experience of being the parent of a child who you never would have wanted. Initially, right? A kid who has something, quote unquote, wrong with them. And, you know, in many cases, that's a parent's worst nightmare. And obviously, there are some times where things go south and they never come back. But in the stories, many of the stories that we tell in this film, and in many of the stories Andrew tells in his book, parents learn to love what's right in front of them. And when they do, when they come through, it's that much sweeter because it's so hard-earned, because they've struggled so much. And that, for me, is really, and I say this as a parent, it's one of the most powerful messages that the film has, which is, you know, when you love somebody, and most of us love our children, it really doesn't matter. And you can find such exquisite joy in learning to be that intimate with someone who's that different.
You are profiling parents who have children who are not like a lot of children, but ultimately they are families. And they're talking about how we love each other, how we connect with each other, how we look at our children, how children look at their parents. And I can't watch this film without thinking about my own family. And I wonder how, in the process of making this film, how it changed the way you thought about your own family, because you're a parent as well.
It was pretty transformative for me to make this film as a human being, I would say, even more than as a parent, because I see people who are different so differently than I did before I started the film. And in terms of my own kids, I guess I would say all of our kids, in some ways, are far from the tree, right? We all think, when we have children, on some level, we all think they're going to be, as Andrew puts it, a carbon copy, a reproduction of who we are. But as he says, there is no such thing as reproduction. You know, having children is an act of production. It really is. You're giving birth to something that's different than you, whether it's physically different or emotionally different or behaviorally different. You know, they're not going to make the same choices. They're not going to do the same things. They're going to, you know, they're going to veer. And, you know, making this film for me was just a lesson in that and in how great that is. And now, you know, I don't know how much of it has to do with making the film, but when I see now that my children are becoming adults, I see them going in such different directions than I did and operating so differently. And I find that kind of thrilling. I don't have a sense or an illusion that I can control that or that there's any reason that they would behave the way that I would have or did.
Rachel Dretson is the director and producer of Far From the Tree. Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
The documentary Far From the Tree opens in Los Angeles this Friday. Up until recently, singer-guitarist Naya Izumi was performing on the streets of L.A. and barely making enough money to pay for rent and food. But since winning NPR's Tiny Desk Concert Contest, he's played a string of sold-out shows on his very first tour of the U.S. I got to sit in on a rehearsal just before he hit the road. Just one song into a rehearsal at his manager's studio apartment overlooking Echo Park Lake, Naya Izumi abruptly puts down his guitar and slips out the back door to get some air. Kind of overwhelmed right now, he says, just above a whisper. Izumi struggles with mild autism, and it's mostly under control, without medication. But certain circumstances can still overwhelm.
I knew how to handle it. No, I need to leave the room and breathe and count backwards and get my analytical mind back in circuit. Then I can push through, even though I still feel stuff. Don't hide your eyes.
Face what you fear. Izumi says music's always been something of a refuge, a focus for a restless mind, and an escape from a troubled childhood in Georgia. In addition to guitar, he also mastered the drums, stand-up bass, and pretty much any instrument that appeals to him.
It was a calling towards loving myself, towards being in the moment. I learned so much about life through whatever instrument that I play at. I'm very, very into every single detail. I literally take things apart. All that we have lost
can be restored piece by piece. Much of Izumi's material revolves around fluid, funky, percussive guitar lines. The fingers of both hands often flying up and down the neck of his guitar as if it was a keyboard. His style has drawn comparisons to King Crimson, Prince, and Jeff Buckley, but he's pretty cagey when asked about musical inspiration.
Just sound. I don't play notes. I play feelings. When you listen to sounds and emulate those sounds and feelings, all these senses using your whole body. Percussion especially, you can definitely feel your bones.
Well, it's funny, a lot of your music is really percussive. Like, you can feel it.
Yeah.
A little over a month ago, Izumi was barely eking out a living, busking on the streets of Venice and Hollywood and downtown LA. But unlike many other street musicians, Izumi writes, records, and performs all his own material. During one burst of creativity in 2016, he released a series of 4-song mini-albums via Bandcamp every month, locking himself away in a small makeshift studio garage in South LA.
I can record a whole song and have it done in like less than a day. Lock myself up and do it. I spend so much time with my music, it's just there when I'm ready for it.
On the strength of this song, Izumi beat out nearly 5,000 other performers to win NPR's annual Tiny Desk Song Contest. It's called Soft Spoken. Don't judge a book by its cover. Soft Spoken was originally written and recorded as Soft Spoken Woman. Izumi says he's struggled with gender identity for years, and a few years ago began the process of transitioning. At a show I saw a couple years ago at a dive bar in LA, Izumi had long black flowing hair, and he wore a long black dress and identified as a woman. Last year, he recorded a video and posted it on YouTube to announce that he was, in his words, detransitioning.
Screw it. It's gonna be hard, but I really want to try to come to terms with my biology. I choose to share my life because I'm a real person. I'm not a faker, and people make things bigger than what they really are. And that's really the whole lesson. It's just be here, love who you are, love what you're doing, love who you're with, and I don't keep all this extra stuff in my head. I'm here, and I'm here.
Nye is a beautiful human being.
Andy Ault started managing Izumi a little over a month ago.
Music flows right through Nye, and Nye has a subtlety, the art of playing guitar. His forearm is holding down a whammy bar, a tremolo, while there's odd signature time tapping, and it's incredibly musical, and there's vocal. That's a dedication that I haven't seen reproduced anywhere else in a human being. I don't care who. I don't care.
We can do that again.
Sure. Do you like that? Like kind of just the ambient kind.
On the weekend before a mini tour of the US, Izumi runs through a batch of songs with his new bass player, Maddie J, a recent graduate of the Berklee School of Music.
You know, I'm used to communicating with people in the way that we learned from music school through charts or through like, hey, I'm playing this chord and like this is the time signature. But playing with Nye, he just plays and then I listen and it feels so musical rather than having to talk about it.
My whole mentality is to take my music to the next level, is to just play and do it and let myself be found. I'll play anywhere I'm allowed to play. I don't care if it's one person or 5 million people watching me. I'm still doing the same thing that I'm gonna do anywhere. nobody's going to stop me from playing.
And that's all for today. Remember to keep up with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Join us back here tomorrow.